This is The State of Things. I'm Frank Stachow. Remember your first crush? Mine was Miss Pat, the local host of a TV show, Romper Room. I was 4. I don't know, it might have been the way she handed me that little carton of milk. It was special, I know. Or the fact that she let me hold her hand. I don't know what happened to Miss Pat, but in my heart, I'm sure she is alive and well, and I know she is still beautiful. Our early encounters with romantic infatuation and heartbreak helped define us as adult partners, lovers, and even friends. Andrea N. Richeson is a writer and editor who goes by Nikki. She specializes in anthologies. For her latest collection, Nikki wanted to explore the resonant effects of first crushes and first loves. The result is a book called Crush, 26 Real-Life Tales of First Love, and Nikki joins me in the studio now, along with a local contributor, Katie Herzog. They're going to be at the Regulator tonight in Durham and at Flyleaf in Chapel Hill tomorrow, but they're here right now. Welcome to both of you. Great to have you on the show.
Thank you, Frank. It's great to be here.
Thank you.
Let me start by asking each of you if there's a difference, and Nikki, I'll start with you, between a first crush and a first love.
I think there's a big difference, and that distinction isn't one that's made perfectly clear in the collection, but as you just explained with your love story with Pat,
Miss Pat,
it's made a lasting impression on you and one that you never forget, and I think that's the appeal of this book, that it's something we can all remember fondly, maybe with a little bit bittersweet nostalgia. But to answer your question, you know, I think the first love is a little more shattering and devastating, maybe, because it often doesn't last.
Yeah. In most cases. Well, Katie, how does it? I mean, what is the distinction, do you think, between that crush and that love?
I think, in essence, crushes aren't as serious as love. Love is hopefully a relationship, and crushes can just be infatuation.
Yeah, but when they're going on, when you have that crush, what is more serious?
I think
nothing matters, right?
That's true. Nothing matters. But they're fleeting. You know, I think love definitely makes it more serious.
So it's kind of the aftermath. That's the way you look back on it. And that's what you do is write. I mean, I think one of the interesting things you do, Nikki, is you're asking writers to reflect on that. You're not asking, drawing us through it. It's really having it and then looking back.
Yeah, and I think for most of these people, these contributors, I was sort of in awe of them because in my introduction, I sort of briefly described my own first love. But for them, they had to remember somewhat accurately and thoroughly convey how they felt, who they were, what that person meant to them. And, you know, for me, it was quite a long time ago. So just remembering and being able to write it so beautifully. And so, you know, I'm in awe of them. I really am.
Now, Katie, in your essay, you describe your twin sister as your first love. Why?
I think that's pretty common with siblings. But when you're a twin, you know, you grow up together and you can't really have a more intimate relationship with that. And then part of being a twin is, you know, growing apart and, you know, having romantic love with people or, you know, friend love, different things like that. But I think just, you know, proximity, it's really hard for twins to be closer to anybody else but each other.
You call alcohol your third love and your first girlfriend, Alice, your second love.
Mm-hmm.
Describe for us how all this unfolded.
Well, I met my first girlfriend when I was 20 years old, and we were together for 4 years. For mostly good years. Didn't end quite so well. But I started drinking. We moved to the West Coast together, and I started drinking sort of more heavily than just sort of college binge drinking. And that took a pretty serious toll on my relationship with my girlfriend. And so I guess in the end, I sort of essentially, without realizing it, chose alcohol over a person with total unawareness.
But you're, and again, on reflection, you see it as one of the most important relationships in your life, albeit a destructive one.
Absolutely, yeah.
And you can contextualize that. Well, and welcome to the program right now, Suzanne Finnemore, who is also a contributor to the book Crush. Suzanne, welcome.
Thank you.
Your essay is partly about having a serious crush at age 50. Tell us about meeting Tom.
Oh, well, we met online, which is sort of a shocking way to encounter anyone, and yet it happens every day. And it was very exciting. We met online, and he asked me to marry him, I think it was 10 days later. And that's a crushing event, if there ever was one.
I think one of the interesting things about this is that it's quick, it's deep, it's moving emotionally. But at age 50, how is it different from that very first crush when you were whatever, adolescent, pre-adolescent?
Well, it's totally unexpected. That's the thing. It's as though you're waiting for a bus that you have no expectation is going to arrive, and suddenly here it comes.
And it's driven by
this marvelous person right. who actually thinks you're terrific, even though you're 50.
And you had both been through a divorce, so again, you'd think you'd be smart enough to know that you don't get bowled over by this stuff anymore, right?
Yeah, you would think that you'd be smart enough to know, but you'd be wrong.
and that's a good thing. That's good.
It's the triumph of It's a triumph of love over experience, basically. Tom was very insistent. He was very insistent that this was really happening. And I said, "Well, I'm not sure. Is this happening?" And he said, "Yes, it's really happening." And he managed to produce a ring. And there were a lot of children in the room, which seemed to add credence to the whole event. We have three kids between us, so.
And that certainly complicated things.
In a marvelous way, the presence of witnesses, many of whom share your genes, lends a certain
right. And you can't make up a whole story because the kids are going to rat you out.
Oh, that's what they do. That's their job. It's their job to rat you out. And, my son now had his first crush. He's 12, and it was absolutely horrifying. Because I didn't expect that it was going to happen to him, but of course it is going to happen to him. It's going to happen to everyone,
Nikki,
as they hit adolescence. And I met the girl. She was very nice, and it's still completely terrifying.
Nikki, you are, of course, editing this anthology, so you're collecting stories from midlife like Suzanne's and young lovers like Katie. Do you see a difference? Is there a generational split?
Somewhat. I mean, that was a problem while editing the collection because it became apparent early on that some of the essays lacked perspective or wisdom, and that's when I found Suzanne and some other authors I greatly admire. It does, but, we all, as I said before, we all remember that same experience, the euphoria and exhilaration of first love and then the devastation afterwards. But I think as a young person, the first time you experience it, there's such a loss of innocence because you're rejected and you become guarded and less willing to risk yourself. And you were so open to life and new experience before that,
Yeah, but
well, that's why they call it crush.
Exactly.
Right.
Instead of, wonderment and perfection.
Yeah, but I want to stay with the feeling that you get before the downfall because it does come back. I mean, in Suzanne's case, and it does, and maybe I'll get you all to comment on this.
It doesn't change. That's what's so shocking is it's exactly the same feeling, if not more intense at 50 than as it was, at 15.
So what does that say about the indestructibility of this thing? You can give it a lot of names. Even though we have perspective and wisdom and experience and pain, all of which should militate and argue against ever feeling like that again.
Well, you think you can be, you think that you're jaded and you think that you're bitter and you actually can sound jaded and bitter, but if I guarantee you, if someone walks up to you and hands you, a bouquet of flowers and says, "I think you're marvelous. Will you marry me?" You're probably going to say yes. You're going to be very excited,
no matter
how old you are.
Katie, what do you think? As somebody who hasn't gotten to that point yet where we expect you to be jaded, but you've had some bad moments. You've had disappointments. You've suffered the pain.
Yeah, I certainly have. I think the really the big difference between a crush and love is that with crushes and also with new love, from my experience, what I've realized is that when I have a crush on somebody, it's usually the idea of her rather than the her of her. And then love starts sort of once you get over the idea of the person and they're sort of not just a theoretical goal, a sort of dream person, but they're actually human. And if the crush lasts, then I suppose that's love. But if not, then it's...
Yeah, but you may have put your finger on one of the most important things in all human relationships, which is when you fail to let go of the idea of that person.
Absolutely.
You go into it, you get married, and you have the kids, and the person you don't want to lose isn't the spouse or the loved one. It's the idea of that person.
Yeah.
That's the hard part.
Mm-hmm.
The person's never done you any good from the start if you'd have bothered to look and if you'd looked at yourself.
Right.
Well, yeah, and I think children really, they bring a real a reality to a relationship very quickly. You know, it's very hard to ignore reality when you have a 3-year-old, a 7-year-old, and a 12-year-old in the house with you. You know, you can no longer just rhapsodize and play funky music and drink red wine.
Well, but that's also one of the downside of that, and the problem there, would you say, Suzanne, is that when these witnesses testify against you in their lives,
and they will.
That you become you can ignore them and you can become hostile in a way just because they're ratting you out.
I'm very lucky that our shared children, you know, they actually they seem to be very excited. I think it's that, you know, they're because they're young, perhaps.
Mm-hmm.
They're not, you know, they're very excited about us being together. And, you know, maybe if they were later teenagers, they would just kind of snub us and shun us. But instead, they seem to be very excited, and they make us Valentines, and they, you know, they participate fully because, you know, they haven't been crushed yet in that sense. So they haven't lost their innocence, and so they can celebrate our marriage, you know, in a full way that sometimes is even hard for us, you know.
Well, and when they become teenagers and snub you and ignore you, it won't be because of the marriage. I guarantee
you.
Yes,
it's
because they're teenagers.
Life. Exactly.
Yeah.
It's just they just completely ignore you and you don't exist.
That's what they do.
We don't exist, and that's okay, too.
Nikki, I want to talk about some of the other essays in this book mm-hmm. as well. Tell us about Sheila Kohler's essay.
Sheila Kohler is a South African writer living in New York. Now she's a novelist, and she married quite young and was living in France with her husband and three daughters. And her husband was philandering, and he had fallen in love with another woman. And she sort of describes this sort of Bronte kind of Mr. Rochester kind of falling in love with the dark brooding guy. And he doesn't hide it from her, and he comes back after having an affair with her, and she somehow sticks around for a while, and then eventually, recognizes that it can't continue. And then she, at the end of the essay, she meets her second husband, who she's been happily married to for 30 years now. And he had also been scorned and hurt by his ex-wife. So there, it's kind of that risking herself again, being willing to do that after being hurt. That's the theme of hers, I would
say. And there are some men in this book. How are they? Are their essays different than the women?
They are, because I would say the men are more in the pursuit of women, rather. And women seem to be kind of caught up in their own doubts and their body image and all these things, you know, being attractive to. I mean, that's not true of Katie's, obviously. So there are a few that aren't just about that male-female dynamic. But.
And Suzanne, I think you're about to say something.
Well, I was going to say that's the beauty of the, you know, what I see as the beauty of the Crush book is that, you know, I'm not sure there is a common thread between the essays. You know, I think they all come at it, you know, there are as many kinds of crushes as there are, you know, you know, colors, really, and in any painting. And, you know, it's just as though, you know, my first husband is dramatically different from my second husband, and Lord, we wouldn't have it any differently, would we? I mean, do we really marry the same person over again? Please tell me we don't.
Right. Well, and of course, you've changed quite a bit, too. So.
Yes, I've become poorer and more realistic.
And Nikki, whose essay was hardest for you to read?
The one that made the biggest impression or the strongest impression on me was Melissa Phoebos. And hers is very edgy and dark. She wrote about having this past working as a dominatrix and living in New York, living a very urban lifestyle and working as a writer, going to grad school and falling in love with a man and trying to hide her past from him. And, you know, to know someone is to reveal everything about ourselves. So she couldn't really be intimate with him and hide this sort of ghost. You know, her essay is called Giving Up the Ghost. And that's, for me, I just felt that, you know, that her longing, and she sort of describes it so beautifully and so, you know, in the end, you know, it doesn't last. Yeah. And so she goes on to fall in love with a woman, and now she's happily in a relationship with that woman. So
And she did get rid of the ghost, so there was at least that, which who knows if that was
I think she's still
desire.
Haunted by her ghost.
At least in that moment was able to be. Katie, talk about that, the idea of going back over a difficult past. Clearly, while you were going through it, you were talking to people. That's one thing. Is it different to be this reflective and to write an essay that everybody's going to read?
It is certainly different. I'm sort of surprised that I write a blog. That's sort of how I started how I started putting my stuff in public, and it's certainly different. My essay was excerpted on Salon, and so a lot more people read it, which I found out when my mom texted me, "You're on Salon. I'm reading whether you want me to or not." So
I thought it was it's a great essay. I loved it.
Thank you.
Wonderful.
So I definitely feel more exposed than I thought that I would, but it's also, I am open about my past. And I sort of, this is a story that I come back to that I write over and over again. And I hope that maybe this will be the last time that I write it.
Right. Well, I mean, was it difficult for you to do, or did you find it all therapeutic once you got through it?
I've written this particular story in so many different versions that when Nikki contacted me and I had a pretty short deadline to write it, that I didn't really reflect on it at the time what the implications were going to be when it was actually published.
So now you've got plenty of time, the rest of your life, and all of those texts from Mom. I thank all of you for being on the show today. Nikki Richeson, Suzanne Finnemore, and Katie Herzog. Thanks so much for being here.
Thank you for having us.
Nikki's the editor, Suzanne and Katie contributors to a new anthology called Crush, 26 Real Life Tales of First Love. They're going to be at the Regulator Bookshop in Durham tonight, 7 o'clock, Flyleaf Bookstore in Chapel Hill at noon tomorrow. Suzanne's latest book is called Split, A Memoir of Divorce. That's the state of things for today. Thanks for being with us. You can find us at stateofthings.org. We're on Facebook as well. The State of Things is produced by Alex Granados. Anna Cassell is our intern. Robin Copley is the technical director. Managing editor Lindsay Foster Thomas. Susan Davis is our senior producer. Peter Baumbar sitting in on the board today. This is North Carolina Public Radio. It's a broadcast service of the University of North Carolina, Chapel Hill. I'm Frank Stachow.